Defense Secretary Ash Carter has nominated senior officers to lead the Army and Navy. He recommends Admiral John Richardson to be the next Chief of Naval Operations and General Mark Milley as the Army's next Chief of Staff. Both now face Senate confirmation. What sorts of challenges will they face atop these military branches? And for some answers, we turn to Nora Bensahel. She's a distinguished scholar in residence at American University. Nora, good morning.
Good morning.
All right, so let me just ask you a process question here. Is this really a White House appointment, or can the Secretary of Defense have a lot of say or discretion over the service chiefs?
Well, the Secretary of Defense has a tremendous amount of discretion, and really it's a decision that, of course, the White House approves and will weigh in on, but it's really a decision made by the Secretary of Defense with a lot of input, although not always the picks that they want from the current Joint Chiefs of Staff, the current service chiefs.
And is it always, when you're going from a bunch of four stars to the four star, I guess you could say, for each of these agencies, the Army and the Navy, how does the vetting work? I mean, how do the names come to the Secretary of Defense in the first place? He can't know them all that well yet.
First of all, particularly this Secretary of Defense has had a tremendous amount of time in the Pentagon in the past, during the Obama administration, first as the head of acquisition, logistics, and technology, and then as the Deputy Secretary of Defense. So Ash Carter knows the current crop of four stars fairly well, and usually the person who is picked to be the service chief is a currently serving four star. That's not always been the case, but it would be extraordinarily unusual to pick someone who isn't. So that narrows down the pool quite a bit.
I guess if it was not a four-star, there'd be a lot of mad four-stars when the announcement came.
That's right, and it's been done before. General Schoomaker was brought back out of retirement in the early 2000s, for example, to be the Army Chief of Staff, but it's extremely unusual when that happens.
Now, there's something that both of these gentlemen have in common, Admiral Richardson and General Milley, and both of them dealt with, and pretty harshly, tamped down on scandals within their respective armed services, the cheating in the nuclear program in the case of the admiral. And so I guess the question is, does this say more about them or does it say more about Ashton Carter?
I don't think it has to do just with the scandals, although that's obviously been very important issues facing both of those services. I think that these are both very unusual picks for these two offices, and there are a number of similarities between them, even though their backgrounds are extremely different. They're both very early in their current assignments. General Milley has been at Forces Command for less than a year, and Admiral Richardson has been the head of nuclear reactors for only 2.5 years out of what is an 8-year term. That's a very, very unusual post in the military. So that's notable. They're clearly being picked for a reason because that's very early, as I said, in both of those current assignments. They have unusual backgrounds. Both of them have Ivy League degrees, which is relatively uncommon among the service chiefs. But I think what they both share, and we were talking about this a little bit a moment ago, is I think that Secretary Carter knows them both very well, sees qualities in them that align with his leadership priorities for the department.
And we should point out that for his part, General Milley was the person who decided that Sergeant Bo Bergdahl would be charged with desertion and misbehavior before the enemy. So maybe it's not so much the scandal as maybe he sees in these gentlemen people that can make tough decisions under a lot of pressure.
That's right, and they both have tremendous operational experience, too. I mean, General Milley's background, if you look at it, has served in 7 divisions, on quite a number of difficult assignments, and Admiral Richardson as well, as a submariner and then in the staff assignments he's had. So I wouldn't, just highlight that, but that's certainly going to be a factor, when the Secretary of Defense picks any person for those leadership positions. But again, I think part of it is the respective experience, particularly from their recent assignments, that they bring to the table. Not saying that it's because they had those assignments, but part of the reason why they may have been selected for those assignments may be part of the reason why Secretary Carter was interested in having them lead their respective services.
All right, so let's talk about the Navy first. A lot of issues there. What would you say that, if he's confirmed, that Admiral Richardson would have to deal with first, or what are the big issues that he's going to face coming in, presuming he's confirmed?
One of the biggest issues facing the Navy today is just how expensive it is to build ships. The cost overruns on a lot of their modernization programs are substantial. One of the things that Admiral Richardson has done that he would have worked closely with Ash Carter on is trying to bring down the cost of the Ohio-class submarines, which is a very expensive program. But that's one of the biggest challenges facing the Navy overall. How does it bring down its budget for the ships that it wants to build? Because the number of ships matters greatly to the Navy, and the types of ships and their capabilities matter greatly. That's going to be one of the biggest challenges for him.
And so how do you, I mean, what are the techniques for lowering cost? I mean, unless there's some revolutionary breakthrough in manufacturing, you'd just have to build less of them.
Well, part of it has to do with the requirements process, too, that the services impose. It's not, you know, it takes so long these days to build a ship or an airplane or a tank or something, you know, big piece of military equipment, that what happens very often is, you know, the initial contract is let, and then the services themselves add on more requirements, particularly as time goes along, and that increases the cost and delays production, which then leads them to add more requirements along the way. So it's not just a matter of, you know, building it according to the specifications of the original contract. There have to be some changes along the way simply because the timeline is so long, but you do have some leeway in how you manage that, what requirements you let through, how you write the contract at the beginning, and things like that.
And so that's where the nuclear experience could really come in handy, because the most expensive vessels are all nuclear-powered.
That's right, and one of the other things that, you know, one of the other reasons why Secretary Carter, I'm sure, knows Richardson very well, Admiral Richardson, is precisely because he's talked about the importance, the Secretary of Defense has talked about the importance of upgrading the nuclear arsenal. So that's another thing that Admiral Richardson brings to the table that the Secretary of Defense would be particularly interested in addition to, of course, the broader leadership and, you know, ability to lead the service.
Just a detail question. Is there much knowledge crossover between nuclear-powered propulsion systems and nuclear explosives launched atop of regular conventional types of warheads, or rockets, I should say, the warheads and the rockets?
I must confess I don't know the answer to that.
Because one is supposed to explode and one is not supposed to explode.
Well, that's right. I'm not a nuclear physicist, so I can't give you the details of that. But, you know, obviously, you know, most of what the chief of nuclear reactors is doing in his previous position is actually making sure that the nuclear-powered ships can run.
Okay. We're speaking with Nora Bensahel. She's Distinguished Scholar in Residence at the School of International Service at American University. Let's talk about the Army side. I guess the big issue there is the blanket isn't big enough to cover the bed anymore.
Yeah, the biggest issue that General Milley will face if he's confirmed is to oversee the downsizing of the Army. It's still not clear exactly what its the ultimate force size will be. It's likely to be 450,000 troops, could be lower than that, down to as low as 420,000, although a final decision on that hasn't been made yet. But that's exactly right. The challenge for him will be, how do you take the service from the number of personnel that it has today and bring it down to those levels. General Milley's most recent assignment is at Forces Command, and that's the command that tasks and manages missions for soldiers that are based in the United States. He's only been in that position since August, so less than a year in that position, but I do think that part of that experience is why the Secretary would have chosen him. General Milley was a very surprised pick to most Army observers, and I think most people in the Army as well. You know, whenever a service chief is scheduled to step down, there's always a parlor game of trying to figure out who the next nominee is going to be. And General Milley's name was not on the top of most people's lists for the likely next chief. I do think that experience at ForceCom and Secretary Carter wanting to try to ensure that drawdown goes as smoothly as possible, again, in addition to his incredible operational experience in the force, would have been a powerful combination that was one of the reasons that led to his nomination.
And, of course, the United States has been through these cyclical army sizes over the past century, really. And given the fact that he's something of a historian, something of a thinker, something of a philosopher, I guess, would Ash Carter, do you think, be looking at these cyclical drawdowns and thinking, is there something we can learn so that we're prepared, at least nominally, the next time around?
I do think that's one of the key challenges facing the Army. You know, it's not just how do you bring it down today in the short term, and that's obviously going to be a very important challenge. But how do you do that in a way that sets up the force to grow again when it inevitably does? I don't know when that will be, but as you noted, it is cyclical. At some point, there will be a desire to have more army forces, you know, whether that's a couple of years from now or much further down the road. And so that's part of the challenge, is how do you cut in a way that makes it, you know, the least painful process possible when it's time to start regrowing.
Nora Bensahel is Distinguished Scholar in Residence at American University. Thanks so much for that insight.
Great. Thank you very much.